and the exteriors of all the buildings, which means we'll be able to continue working on the interiors through the winter. So, when may I schedule the formal ribbon cutting? Next spring? Pilcher smiles, imagining it, a warm day in May, and the valley popping with blossoms and the baby greens and yellows of new leaves. A fresh start. Humanity's blank slate. Have you considered how you'll explain all of this to the first residents? They walk down the middle of the street, Pilcher eyeing the scaffolding fronting the building that will become the opera house. I imagine there will be some shock and disbelief at the outset, but once they understand what I've given them the chance to be a part of, they'll fall on the ground thanking you, Pope says. Pilcher smiles. A flatbed truck carrying a load of raw lumber rumbles past. Can you fathom being given this opportunity? Pilcher muses. In the world we came from, our existence was so easy, and so full of discontent because it was so easy. How do you find meaning when you're one of 7 billion? When food, clothing, everything you need is just one Walmart away? When we numb our minds to sleep on all manner of screens and HD entertainment, the meaning of life, of our existence and purpose, becomes lost. And what is that? Pope asks. What is what? Our purpose? To perpetuate our species, of course. To reign over this planet. And we will again. Not in your or my lifetime, but we will. The people I bring out of suspension to populate my town won't have Facebook or iPhones, iPads, Twitter, next-day delivery. They'll interact like our species used to, face to face. And they'll live knowing they're the last of humanity, that outside our fence are 1 billion monsters that want to devour them. With that knowledge, they'll abide in a full understanding that in the fence of these enormous stakes, their lives have taken on incomprehensible worth. And isn't that all we want in the end? To feel useful? Of value? Pilcher smiles as his town, his dream, comes to life before his eyes. He says, "This place is going to be our Eden." The Turners. Jim Turner kissed his 8-year-old daughter on the forehead and wiped away the tears that were streaming out of her eyes. She said,
"But I want you to stay with us."
"I have to go secure the house."
"I'm scared."
"Mommy's staying with you."
"Why are people screaming outside?"
"I don't know," he lied.
"Is it because of those monsters? We learned about them in school. Mr. Pilcher protects us from them."
"I don't know what they are, Jessica, but I have to go make sure you and Mommy are safe, okay?" The little girl nodded. "I love you, sweetheart."
"I love you too, Daddy."
He stood, put his hands on his wife's face, couldn't see her in the darkness, but he could feel her lips trembling, the wetness of tears running over them. He said, "You have water, food, a flashlight." He tried to make a joke out of it, even a pot to piss in. She grabbed his neck, put her lips to his ear.
"Don't do this."
"There's no other way, and you know it."
"The basement."
"It won't work. The boards are too long to go across the door." He heard their neighbors, the Millers, dying in their home across the street. "When it comes time to get out,
you'll break us out."
"I want nothing more. But if I'm not here to do it, use the crowbar. You'll have to wedge it into the jam."
"We should have stayed with the others."
"I know, but we didn't, and now we're doing the best we can. No matter what you hear in this bedroom, you stay in this closet and you don't make a sound. Cover her ears if..."
"Don't say that." "If what, Daddy? Oh, God, don't say that."
"I love you, my girls. Now I have to shut this door."
"No, Daddy."
"Quiet, Jess," he whispered. Jim Turner kissed his wife. He kissed his daughter. Then he shut them into the bedroom closet on the second floor of their lavender-colored Victorian. His toolbox was already open on the floor. He flicked on his flashlight and chose a suitable 2x4 from the pieces of scrap lumber he'd carried in from the shed, remnants of a doghouse he'd built last summer. Those warm afternoons working in the backyard. Mrs. Miller's screaming jettisoned the memory into oblivion.
No, 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 no! Oh, God!
Jessica was crying in the closet, Gracie struggling to comfort her. Jim grabbed a hammer. He started nails on each end of the board. Screws would have been preferable, but there was no time. He held the pine board across the doorframe and drove the nails into the studs. His mind wouldn't stop. He kept replaying what the sheriff had said, but he couldn't wrap his head around it. How could this be all that was left of humanity? By the time he had 4 boards nailed across the doorframe, the Millers had gone quiet across the street. He dropped the hammer, wiped his brow, dripping with sweat. Kneeling down, he put his lips to the closet door.
Jessica? Gracie?
I can hear you,
his wife said. You're nailed in, Jim said. Now I have to go find a place to hide.
Be safe.
He put his hand on the door.
I love you both so much.
She said something back, but he couldn't hear the words. Too muffled, too faint, too ruined by tears. Rising to his feet, he grabbed the flashlight and the hammer, the nearest thing to a weapon in his toolbox. At the bedroom door, he turned the lock and closed it gently behind him. The hallway was dark. The last half hour had been so filled with shouting and shrieks that the silence struck him wrong, like a lie. Where will you hide? How will you survive? He stopped at the top of the staircase. He was tempted to use the light, but feared it might draw attention. With a hand on the banister for a guide, he went slowly down the creaking steps. The living room stood in impenetrable shadow. Jim moved to the front door. He locked the deadbolt, but he had a feeling that didn't matter. From what he'd seen, these things were running through the windows. Stay inside? Go? On the other side of the door, he heard something scrape. Leaned into the peephole. There were no street lamps working, but he could actually see outside, the pavement and the picket fences and the cars just faintly illuminated by residual starlight. 3 of those things were crawling up the flagstones that led from the picket fence to the front door. He'd caught glimpses of them streaking down the street from his second-floor bedroom window, but he hadn't yet seen one up close. None of them were larger than he was, but their muscle tone was extraordinary. They looked like humanity wrapped in the trappings of a monster. Equipped with talons instead of fingers, teeth designed for cutting and tearing, they brandished arms that seemed too long in proportion to the rest of their body, longer even than their legs. He said under his breath, like a prayer, "What the hell are you?" They reached the porch. Fear suddenly wore him like a glove. He backed away from the door, moving through the dark again, between the sofa and the coffee table, and then into the kitchen, where the starlight filtered through the window over the sink just sufficiently to brighten the linoleum and light the way. Jim set the hammer on the counter and took the back door key off the nail beside the door. Something crashed into the front door as he worked the key into the lock. A wood-splintering, lock-rattling collision. He turned the key, the deadbolt retracting. Ripped open the back door as the front door punched open. The steps leading up to the second floor, to the bedroom, to the closet where his girls were in hiding, would be the first thing those monsters saw. Jim walked several steps back into the kitchen and said, "Hey guys, over here!" An eardrum-riving shriek filled the house. He couldn't see a thing, but he heard those creatures slamming through tables and chairs as they came for him. He tore back through the kitchen, shutting the door after him and launching down the single step into his perfect square of grass, past the doghouse, toward the fence. Glass broke behind him. As he reached the gate that opened into the alley, he glanced back, saw one of those things climbing through the kitchen window as the other two flung themselves into the back door. He flipped open the hasp and dug his shoulder into the gate.
Ethan.
The shrieks of the Abbeys were less than a block away as Ethan lowered himself through the opening, grabbed hold of the handle on the underside of the trap door, and pulled it closed over the top of him. The tunnel swelled with the reverberating noise of 100 voices down below, loud enough to drown out the Abbeys. He searched, but there was no lock on this side of the hatch, no method of securing it against the world above. Ethan descended the ladder, 25 rungs down to the floor of a tunnel, brimming with the firelight of a dozen torches. It was a 6x6 culvert of crumbling concrete, broken by roots and vines and a couple thousand years old. It ran beneath the town, and aside from the cemetery, it represented the last original construction left over from 21st century wayward pines. It felt cold and dank and ancient. People stood single file, their backs against the walls like schoolchildren assembled for some terrifying drill, tense, expectant, shivering, some wide-eyed, others blank-faced, as if in complete denial of what was happening. Ethan jogged up the tunnel to Kate. "Everybody in?" she asked. "Yeah, lead the way. Hector and I will bring up the rear." As Ethan moved back down the line, he held his finger to his lips, urging silence. When he passed his wife and son, he caught Teresa's eye and winked, squeezing her hand as he hurried by. They had already begun to move as he neared the end. He pulled the last torchbearer out of line. She tended bar at the beer garden on weekends, Maggie something.
"What do you want me to do?"
she asked. She was young, scared. Ethan said, "Just hold your light. It's Maggie, right?"
"Yeah."
"I'm Ethan."
"I know."
"Let's go." The group moved slowly enough as a whole for Ethan, Hector, and Maggie to backpedal without fear of falling. The torchlight flickered across the crumbling concrete, illuminating an empty stretch of tunnel 40 feet behind them, the walls fringed with light, the center space disturbingly black. There was the sound of footsteps in water, a few hushed voices, and little else. As they traveled, Ethan's mind wandered to Teresa and Ben. They were only 50 feet away, but he didn't like being any distance from them under these conditions. They came to a junction. Maggie's torch momentarily illuminated the intersecting tunnels. For a split second, Ethan thought he heard screams echoing down through the dark, but they were lost to the sound of his group's passage.
"Are we doing okay?"
Maggie asked, a tremor in her voice. "Yes," Ethan said. "We'll be safe soon."
"I'm cold."
Her costume for the fete was a bikini under a raincoat, and fur-lined boots. Ethan said, "We'll have a fire where we're going."
"I'm scared."
"You're doing great, Maggie." Two junctions later, they hung a right into a new tunnel. As they passed an old iron ladder that climbed into darkness, Ethan stopped.
"What's that sound?"
Hector asked. Ethan looked at Maggie. "Let me have your torch."
"Why?"
He grabbed it and handed her his shotgun. Climbed with one hand on the rungs, one hand gripping the torch. After 10 steps, Hector's voice reached up from below.
"Ethan, not to complain, but I can't see a thing down here.
I'll be back in 1 minute."
"What are you doing?"
Maggie called out. There were tears in her voice, but Ethan kept climbing until his head bumped against the hatch. He clung to the top rung of the ladder, the trap door lit by the firelight, the flame warm near his face. Maggie and Hector were still calling out to him. He eased the trapdoor open. Compared to the tunnel, the starlit town was bright as day. The noise had drawn him up the ladder with screaming, human screaming. And what he saw, he didn't know how to process. How do you make sense of people running down the middle of a street that could have been the cover of a Saturday Evening Post, chased by a horde of monsters, pale white, translucent in the night, some sprinting upright, others moving on all fours with a bounding gait like wolves? You process it piecemeal. A string of indelible images.
shrieks from the nearest house as an Abby plows through the front window. Three Abbeys running down one of the officers of the Fate, who stops to face them at the last moment and swings his machete too early, just missing the nose of the lead Abbey as the other two tackle him to the ground. 30 yards away, an Abbey pulling out loops of gut and shoveling them into its jaws as the man pinned beneath its talons makes the last noise, awful, desperate screaming, he will ever make. In the middle of Main Street, a large Abbey on top of Megan Fisher, violating her. 12 bodies already scattered across Maine, most lying absolutely still in puddles of their own insides, 2 barely crawling, 3 being eaten alive. Like a horrific game, no one running in any particular direction. Ethan had the urge to go above ground and help, save someone, just one person, kill just one of those monsters. But it would be death. He didn't even have his shotgun. This group, 1/4 of Wayward Pines, had been ambushed en route to their trap door. No weapons, save a few machetes. But would it really matter if they'd all been armed? Would it matter for Ethan's group if the Abbeys discovered the tunnels? A terrifying thought. Think about your family. They're below you right now. They need you. They need you alive.
Ethan! Maggie shouted. Come on!
Above ground, a man shot past, running as hard as Ethan had ever seen someone run, the speed and sheer energy output only attainable by someone in fear of an impending, unthinkable death. The Abbey chasing him was on all fours and closing fast, and as the man glanced back, Ethan recognized him as Jim Turner, the town dentist. A second Abbey collided with Jim at full speed, the man's neck snapping from the brute force of the impact. The questions were inescapable. What if Ethan hadn't made this revelation to town? What if he'd let them kill Kate and Harold? Go on with things the way they'd always been? These people would certainly not be dying right now. Ethan carefully lowered the trapdoor and descended. Maggie was hysterical below him, Hector trying to comfort her. Ethan reached the bottom, traded back the torch for the gun, and said, "Let's go." They moved quickly up the tunnel, the rest of their group out of sight.
"What was happening up there?" Maggie asked.
Ethan said, "One of the other groups didn't make it underground in time." Hector said,
"We have to help them."
"There is no helping them."
"What does that mean?" Maggie asked.
Ethan glimpsed a shimmer of torchlight in the distance and quickened his pace. He said, "We need to focus on getting our people to safety, nothing else."
"Were people dying?" Maggie asked.
"Yes."
"How many?"
"I imagine all of them, eventually." The Richardsons. Bob Richardson slid in behind the wheel of his 1982 Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierra and cranked the engine as his wife, Barbara, piled into the front passenger seat beside him.
"This is a stupid idea," she said.
He put the car into gear and eased out into the dark street. "What's yours?" he asked. "Wait inside the house for those things to break in?"
"Your lights aren't on," Barbara said.
"That's intentional, darling."
"You don't think they can hear our engine?"
"Will you shut up and let me drive, please?"
"Of course. This'll be the shortest trip ever taken on account of there being no roads out of town."
Bob turned onto First Avenue. He wasn't about to admit it verbally or by action, which would mean using the lights, but it was pretty dark. Arguably, too dark to drive without headlights. It had been months since he'd been behind the wheel, and he felt rusty. They passed the sheriff's station. With their windows rolled up, the screams emanating from town barely intruded into the tense silence inside the car. Soon, they reached the outskirts. Through his window, Bob could see movement in the pasture.
"They're out there," Barbara said.
"I know it." She reached across his lap and hit the lights. 2 beams shot out across the grassland, eviscerated cows littering the pasture by the dozens, each one surrounded by a cluster of monsters in the throes of gorging themselves. God damn it, Barbara!
They all looked up from their kills, bloody mouths glistening in the high beams. Bob floored the accelerator. They blew past the goodbye sign, a perfect 1950s family, smiling and waving. We hope you enjoyed your visit to Wayward Pines. Don't be a stranger. Come back soon. The road entered the forest. Bob downgraded the high beams to corner lamps, the fog lights just bright enough to keep him straddling the double yellow. Mist swept across the road between the narrow corridor of pines. Bob kept glancing in the rearview mirror, but all he could see was a tiny swath of scrolling pavement lit red by the taillights.
"Go faster," Barbara said.
"I can't. There's a hairpin turn coming up." She climbed between the seats into the back and sat on her knees, staring through the window.
"Anything?" Bob asked.
"No."
"What are we going to do?"
"I don't know, but at least we aren't in town, in the midst of everything. Maybe we could just pull off into a quiet place in the trees," he suggested.
"Ride this out?"
"What if there's no end to it?" she asked. The question hung between them like a black cloud. The road out of town began to curve, and Bob steered into it, keeping their speed under 20 miles per hour. Barbara was crying in the back seat.
"I wish he hadn't told us," she said.
"What are you talking about?"
"Sheriff Burke. This is all happening because he told us the truth."
"You're probably right."
"I'm not saying I loved it here, but you know what?" Barbara sniveled. "I didn't worry about bills. I didn't worry about our mortgage. You and I got to run a bakery."
"You had gotten used to the way of things."
"Exactly."
"But we couldn't talk about our past," Bob said. "We never saw our friends or family. We were forced to marry."
"That didn't turn out so bad," she said.
Bob held his tongue as he drove through the heart of the curve. The road out of town became the road into town. He eased off the gas as they passed the welcome sign. Wayward Pines lay straight ahead, enveloped in darkness. He let the car roll to a stop and killed the engine.
"We just wait here?" Barbara asked.
"For now."
"Shouldn't we keep moving?"
"There's barely any gas left." She climbed back into the front seat. She said,
"People are dying out there. Right now."
"I know."
"That goddamn sheriff."
"I'm glad he did it."
"What?"
"I said I'm glad."
"No, I heard you the first time. I mean, why? Our neighbors are being slaughtered, Bob."
"We were slaves."
"How are you enjoying your new freedom?"
"If this is the end, I'm glad I know the truth."
"You're not scared?"
"I'm terrified."
Bob opened his door. "Where are you going?" Barbara asked.
The interior dome light burned his eyes. "I need a moment alone."
"I'm not getting out of this car."
"That's kind of the point, darling." Ethan. As they closed in on their group, Ethan registered the growing disconnect between what he'd seen above ground and the fact that his people were still alive down here in the tunnel. It reminded him of the sickening, random way that fate and chance figured into battle. If you had stepped left instead of right, the bullet would have gone through your eye instead of your friend's. If Kate had led their group to a different tunnel entrance, it could have been Ethan and his family being slaughtered on Main Street. He was having an impossible time putting Megan Fisher out of his mind. He'd seen enough death and destruction in Iraq to know that it would be poor Megan who haunted his dreams for many nights to come. Knew he would always wonder, what if he'd risked everything and gone outside? What if he'd killed her attacker? Saved her? Carried her back to the tunnel? He would play that scene over and over until it bulked up with the perfection of a fantasy. Anything to replace the image of that woman under the abbey in the middle of the road. There were still moments from the war he carried and would always carry, incomprehensible agony and suffering. This trumped them all. They reached the end of the line just as the group was turning up a new tunnel. Ethan thinking, one quarter of humanity was just wiped out. He looked down the line of his people, saw the back of Teresa's head in the low light. The need to be close to her and Ben was overwhelming. Megan in the street. Stop. Megan screaming. Stop. Megan, a single piercing howl blasted through the tunnel. Maggie and Hector stopped. Ethan raised his shotgun. The torch began to shake violently in Maggie's hand. Ethan glanced back. The line had stalled. Everyone had heard, everyone craning their necks, straining to stare down into the darkness of the tunnel. Ethan said to everyone, "Keep the line moving. Don't stop no matter what. Just go." They went on. After 50 feet, Maggie said, "I think I hear something." "What?" Hector asked. "It's like splashing. Something walking through the water. That's just our group." She shook her head and pointed into the darkness. "It's coming from that direction." Ethan said, "Hold up. Let everybody get ahead of us." As the end of the line pulled away, Ethan squinted into the darkness. Now he heard it too, and it wasn't walking. It was running. His mouth went dry, and he was suddenly aware of his heart banging madly against his chest. "It's time to point your gun, Hector," Ethan said. "Something's coming?" "Something's coming." Maggie took a few steps back. Ethan said, "I know you're scared, but you're our light, Maggie. No matter what you see coming down that tunnel, stand your ground. If you run, we all die. Understand?" The splashing was getting louder, closer. "Maggie, do you understand me?"
"Yes,"
she whimpered. Ethan pumped the shotgun. "Hector, is your safety off?"
"It is."
Ethan glanced back, tried to spot Teresa and Ben in the crowd, but they were too far away and the light was shit. Ethan tugged the black synthetic stock into his shoulder and stared down the barrel. The sights were a self-luminous tritium unit that popped nicely in the dark, three soft green dots. Ethan said, "You're shooting slugs, not buckshot."
"So there's no spread?"
"Exactly. Be accurate."
"What if I run out?"
"Cross that bridge when—" It came out of the dark at a full sprint, barreling low on all fours at an astonishing rate of speed. Greyhound fast. Ethan aimed. Hector fired. Muzzle flash electrifying the tunnel and wrecking Ethan's vision for a millisecond. When Ethan could see again, the Abbey was still coming, 20 feet and 2 seconds away. Maggie hyperventilating, "Oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh—" Ethan fired, the stock jerking back into his shoulder, the report of the shotgun in this confined space like a cannon going off. The Abbey tumbled to a stop 3 feet from Ethan's boots, a large chunk of skull blown out of the back of its head. Hector said, "Wow." His voice sounded muffled against the ringing in Ethan's ears. They began to jog up the tunnel, chasing the end of the line, which was now just a point of firelight in the distance. As Ethan's hearing returned, he picked out new howls echoing through the tunnel. "Faster," Ethan said. He could hear the Abbey's footfalls in the stream, closing in behind them. Kept glancing back into the dark, kept seeing nothing. And they were running, Maggie out in front, Ethan and Hector abreast, elbows grazing every few strides. They crossed a junction. Through the tunnel to their right came screaming, shrieking, wailing. Harold Ballinger. The people at the back shouted first. Screams in the darkness. Human. Inhuman.
"Run! Run! 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 Oh God, they're here! Help me! No! 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 No!"
A great surge pushing through the line, people falling in the water. More cries for help. The agony. Everything unraveling so goddamn fast. Harold spun around to go back, but there was nothing to go back to. All torches had been extinguished. Only darkness and screaming, an explosion of noise ricocheting off the walls of the culvert, and all he could think was that this must be what hell sounded like. He heard gunshots in an adjacent tunnel. "Kate?" Tiffany Golden screamed his name. shouting at him, at everyone to come on. Hurry, don't just stand there. She was 30 feet up the tunnel and clutching their group's last torch. People shoved past Harold. Someone's shoulder butted him back into the wall of crumbling concrete. The screams of the dying were getting closer. Harold started running, sandwiched between two men, their elbows punching into his side as they raced ahead of him toward the diminishing firelight. He didn't think they had that much farther to go, 300-400 yards at the most before the tunnel opened into the woods. If they could make it outside, even half of them? The torch in the distance vanished with a shout. Instantaneous dark. The screams tripling in volume. Harold could taste the panic in the air, some of it his own. He was knocked down in the stream of water, feet trampling over his legs, then his body. Tried to get up, got knocked down again, people scrambling over him like an obstacle, someone stepping on his head. Rolling out of the way, he climbed back onto his feet. Something streaked past him in the dark. It reeked of decay. Several feet away, a man begged for help over the sound of bone and cartilage crunching. Harold's nerve flattened under a veil of crushing disbelief. He should go. Just run. The poor bastard beside him went quiet, and now there was only the sound of the monster devouring its kill. How could this possibly be happening? Fetid breath hit his face. Inches away, a low growl began. Harold said, "Don't do this." His throat felt suddenly hot. His chest turned wet and warm. He could still breathe. He felt no pain, but there was so much blood jetting out of his neck. Already he felt lightheaded. Harold sank down in the freezing stream as the beast opened his stomach with a swipe. There was only a distant, blunted pain as the abbey began to eat. All around him were the moans and cries of the dying, the scared. People still rushed past him in the dark, fighting to get to safety. He didn't make a sound. Didn't fight back. Paralyzed by shock, blood loss, trauma, fear. He couldn't believe this was happening to him. The thing ate him with the intensity of a creature that hadn't fed in days, its rear talons pinning him down by his legs, front talons nailing Harold's arms to the concrete. And still no pain to speak of. He was one of the lucky ones, he figured. He'd be dead before the real pain hit. Ethan. Pure human suffering and terror. Chaos. Ethan shouted, "Don't stop! Keep moving!" Thinking, had another group been run down in an adjacent tunnel? Unimaginable. To be overtaken down here. People climbing over one another to escape as the monsters reached them. Torches dropped, extinguished in the stream, devoured in the dark. Up ahead, the torchlight in Ethan's group had disappeared. Ethan said, panting, "Where'd they go?" "I don't know," Hector said. "The light just vanished." The water under Ethan's boots was rushing now, and they were moving into a cold, steady breeze. They emerged from the tunnel onto a rocky stream bed, and for a moment, the sound of the abbeys was replaced by the roar of white water, close but invisible in the dark. Ethan stared up the hillside, saw the torches trailing up into a forest. He pointed them out to Hector and Maggie and said, "Follow the lights." "You're staying?" Hector asked. "I'll be along." The shrieks of the abbeys cut through the crush of the falls. "Go," Ethan said. Ethan racked a fresh shell into the tube and climbed several feet up to the bank, to a flat perch. His eyes were slowly adjusting. He could discern the silhouettes of trees and even the cascade in the distance, the black water starlit against the sky where it arced over a ledge several hundred feet above. Ethan's quads burned from sprinting through the tunnel, and despite the cold, his undershirt was soaked with sweat. An abbey exploded out of the tunnel and stopped in the stream bed. Took in its new surroundings, looked at Ethan. "Here we go." Its head twitched to the side. When the slug hit the abbey center mass, it fell back into the stream. Two more abbeys ripped out of the tunnel. One rushed to its fallen comrade and let out a low, pulsing cry. The other made a beeline for Ethan, scrabbling up the rocky bank on all fours. Ethan racked a new shell, shot a slug through its teeth. When it fell, the other one was right behind it, and two more already out of the tunnel. Ethan pumped and fired. The other two were coming, and still more screams rising up behind them. He took the first one down with a gunshot, but missed the head of its partner, racked another shell, fired at point-blank range, and hit just below the neck. Blood sprayed in Ethan's eyes. He wiped his face as another Abby joined the party. Ethan pumped, aimed, squeezed the trigger. Click. Shit. The Abby heard the noise. It lunged. Ethan threw down the empty shotgun, drew his Desert Eagle, and put a round through its heart. Gun smoke clouded the air. Ethan's heart hammered away, and there were screams still coming up the tunnel. Go, go, go! He holstered the pistol, grabbed the shotgun, and climbed away from the stream, clawing his way through rocks and dirt until he reached the trees, sweat pouring into his eyes with a salty burn. There were lights in the distance, screams behind him. He slung the shotgun over his shoulder and ran. After a minute, the sound of the Abbeys changed. They were outside now, many of them. He didn't look back, kept going, kept climbing. 3. Adam Tobias Hassler. Hassler Expedition, Northwest Wyoming, 678 days ago. Brightly colored algae rims the bank, and jets of mineral water bubble where they surface up from the molten underworld below. The smell of sulfur and other minerals is strong. Hassler strips naked in the falling snow and covers his clothes and gear under the stinking duster. Hustling through the grass, he glides into the pool and groans with pleasure. Out in the center, it is deep and clear and sky blue. He finds a spot near the shore, a foot and a half deep, and stretches out on a long, smooth rock that boasts a natural incline. Pure, unabashed pleasure. As if it was made for this very thing. He reclines in the 104-degree pool, the snow pouring down, letting his eyes close for little bursts of euphoria that remind him of what it felt like to be human. To live in a civilized world of convenience and comfort, where the probability of death didn't shadow every moment. But the knowledge of where he is, of who he is, of why he is here is never far. A tense voice, the one that has kept him alive for the last 800 and something days in the wild, whispers that it was foolish to stop for a soak in this pool. Indulgent and reckless. This isn't a spa. A swarm of Abbeys could appear at any time. He's normally vigilant to a fault, but this pool is nothing short of a gift, and he knows the memory of his time here will sustain him for weeks to come. Besides, the map and compass are useless in the midst of a blizzard. He's sucked in until the weather passes. He shuts his eyes again, feels the snowflakes, a light on his lashes. Off in the distance, he hears a sound, like water shooting out of the blowhole of a whale, one of the smaller geysers erupting. His own smile surprises him. He first saw this place in the faded color photos of the XYZ Encyclopedia Britannica volume in his parents' basement, a 1960s crowd watching from the boardwalk as Old Faithful spewed boiling mineral water. He's dreamed of coming here since he was a boy. Just never imagined that his first visit to Yellowstone would be in conditions such as these. 2,000 years in the future, and the world gone all to hell. Hassler grabs a handful of gravel and begins to abrade the dirt and filth that has accumulated on his skin like body armor. In the middle of the pool, where the deep water covers his head, he submerges himself completely. Clean for the first time in months, he climbs out of the pool and sits in the frosted grass to let his body cool. Steam lifts off his shoulders. He feels woozy from the heat. Across the meadow, evergreens stand ghost-like, almost invisible through the steam and the snow. And then, something he wrote off as a shrub begins to crawl. Hassler's heart stops. He straightens and squints.
can't pinpoint how far away it is, but clearly inside of 100 yards. Easy to mistake for a man crawling on all fours at this distance, except there are no men in the world anymore. At least not beyond the electrified, razor-wired fence that surrounds the town of Wayward Pines. Well, actually, there is one. Him. The figure draws closer. No, figures. 3 of them. You idiot. He's naked, and his best means of defense, a .357, is tucked away in the pocket of his duster on the far side of the pool. But not even his Smith & Wesson offers much comfort against 3 Abbeys at close range in snowstorm visibility. If he were prepared, if he had spotted them farther out, he might have dropped 1 or 2 with his Winchester. Put a bullet through the last one's skull, point-blank with the revolver. This line of thought is pointless. They're coming toward the pool. Hassler eases soundlessly back into the water, all the way up to his neck. He can scarcely see them now through the steam, praise that lack of visibility cuts both ways. As the Abbeys close in, Hassler lowers himself to his eyes. It is a mature female and 2 lankier adolescents, each of whom clock in around 120, easily lethal. He's seen smaller ones than this bring down full-grown bison. The female is the size of them both combined. From 60 feet away, Hassler watches as the mother stops at his pile of clothes and gear. She lowers her nose to his duster. The young ones come up alongside her and sniff as well. Hassler rises a few millimeters until his nose is just above the surface. With a long, penetrating breath, he goes under, blowing enough air out of his lungs so his body will sink. Soon, he's sitting on the rocky floor of the pool. Streams of burning water shoot up through tiny fissures under his legs. He shuts his eyes, and as the pressure and the ache intensifies in his lungs, the oxygen deprivation manifests as explosions of light. He digs his fingernails into his legs, the thirst for breath growing exponentially, all-consuming. When he can't stand it anymore, he surfaces and drinks in a gulp of air. The Abbeys are gone. He turns slowly in the water, inch by inch by... freezes. The urge to jerk back, to just run, is almost irresistible. 10 feet away at the edge of the pool, one of the young Abbeys crouches down beside the water. Motionless. Head cocked slightly to one side. Transfixed. Studying its reflection? Hassler has seen more than his fair share of these monsters, but mainly through his rifle scope, at a distance. He's never been this close to one undetected. He can't take his eyes off its heart, the beating of the muscle visible through the translucent skin, the blood pumping through its arteries, purple highways, converging center mass, all obscured and blurred as if he watches it behind a sheet of quartz. The Abbey has small eyes that remind him of black diamonds, hard and otherworldly. But strangely enough, it isn't the monster's horrific qualities that so unnerve him. Shining through the 5-taloned claws, the rows of razor teeth, and the devastating physical strength is its humanness. These things have so clearly evolved from us, and now the world is theirs. David Pilcher, Hassler's boss and the creator of Wayward Pines, estimated there were 500 million Abbeys on this continent alone. The steam is thick, but Hassler doesn't dare to slip back under the surface. He doesn't move. And still, the Abbey watches its reflection in the pool. It will either see him and he will die, or, off in the distance, the mother shrieks. The young Abbey's head lifts. The mother shrieks again, her voice filling with the intensity of a threat. The Abbey scuttles off. Hassler listens as the trio moves away from the pool, and by the time he chances the smallest degree of movement, a quick turn of the head, they had vanished into the snowstorm. Hassler waits for a break in the snow, but it never comes. He climbs out of the pool and brushes 3 inches of powder off his duster, and dries off each foot, before sliding them into the boots. He puts the duster on wet and grabs the rest of his gear and jogs across the clearing toward the stand of pines.
ducks under a canopy of low-hanging limbs that protect the ground as thoroughly as a thatched roof. Already shivering, he drops everything and tears open his pack. The old man's beard lies on top, and underneath it, a bundle of dry tinder that he collected that morning. The lichen takes the third spark. As the twigs begin to crackle, Hassler breaks off several larger limbs within reach and snaps them over his knee. The fire roars. The cold departs. He stands naked in the heat of the flames. Soon he is dressed and comfortable, leaning back against the trunk of the tree with his hands held out to the fire. Beyond his weather-protected nook, snow pours down into the meadow. Night creeps in. He is warm, dry, and for the moment, not dead. All things considered, in this shitty new world, that's about as much as a man can hope for at the end of a long, cold day. The next time his eyes open, the sky through the branches is infused with deep blue, and the meadow lies buried beneath a foot of sparkling white. The fire burned out hours ago. The saplings in the meadow bend under the weight of snow like little arches. Courtesy of the hot springs, it's the first time in months that, as Hassler struggles onto his feet, he doesn't feel as stiff as a rusted hinge. He's thirsty, but his water froze overnight. He eats just enough jerky to beat back the mad, raving hunger he always wakes to. Lifting his rifle, he scopes the clearing for any sign of movement. It's a good 20 or 30 degrees colder than yesterday, barely above zero, and plumes of steam ascend in a perpetual cloud off the hot springs. Otherwise, nothing moves in that vast winterscape. He digs out his compass and the little patch of map and then heaves his pack onto his shoulders. Hassler crawls out from under the overhanging branches and sets out across the meadow. It is cold and perfectly still, the sun on the rise. In the center of the meadow, he stops and glasses the terrain through the scope of his Winchester. For the moment, at least, the world is his alone. As the sun climbs, the glare off the snowpack becomes painful. He would stop to retrieve his sunglasses, but the welcome darkness of the forest is just within reach. It's all lodgepole pine. 200-foot giants with straight, thin trunks and narrow crowns. Forest travel is considerably more dangerous, and at the edge of the trees Hassler pulls the .357 out of an inner pocket of his duster and checks the load. The forest climbs. The sun pushes through the pines in splashes of light. Hassler crests the ridge. A lake comes into view that shines like a jewel. Close to shore, the water has frozen, but it's still liquid out in the center. He sits on a bleached tree stump and raises the butt of the rifle to his shoulder. The lake is immense. He scopes the shoreline. There's nothing in the direction he intends to travel but unblemished, glittering white. On the opposite side, a couple miles away, he spots a bull in a bloody patch of snow pulling long ropes of intestines out of a massive grizzly bear whose throat the abbey has torn out. Hassler starts down the gentle slope. At the lake shore, he studies the map again. The forest comes close to the water, and keeping between the shore and the trees, he makes his way around to the western side of the lake. The trek through the snow has worn him out. Hassler unslings his rifle from his shoulder and collapses near the water's edge. In proximity, he sees that the ice isn't thick, just a fragile crust from the hard overnight freeze. This snow has come early, way early. By his reckoning, it's only July. He scopes the shoreline again, the woods at his back. Nothing moving but the abbey across the lake, its entire head now buried inside the grizzly's belly, gorging itself. Hassler leans back against his pack and takes out the map. There is no wind, and with the sun directly above him, he feels warm down to his bones. He loves mornings, without a doubt, his favorite time of day. There is something hopeful about waking in the early light and not yet knowing what the day has in store. Emotionally speaking, late afternoons are the hardest, with the light beginning to fail and the knowledge setting in that he'll be spending another night outside, alone in the dark, the threat of an awful death forever in the wings. but in this moment, at least, the coming night feels very far away. Once again, his thoughts turn north, to Wayward Pines, to the day he'll reach its fence and return to safety, to that little Victorian house on 6th Street, and to the woman he loves with a ferocity he will never fully grasp. It was for her alone that he willingly abandoned his life in 2013, volunteering to be put into suspended animation for 2,000 years, with no idea of what kind of a world he'd be waking to. But just knowing it would be one with Teresa Burke alive in it, and her husband, Ethan, long since dead, was more than enough for him to risk everything. He pairs the map with the compass. The most prominent feature in the region is a 10,000-foot peak that was once called Mount Sheridan. The top 1,000 feet of the peak stand above the timberline, blown stark white against the purple sky. It's windy at the summit, with streamers of snow spraying off the top. An hour's walk in prime conditions, 2 or 3 in a foot of newly fallen snow. For now, it simply represents his north, the direction of home. The Richardsons. Bob climbed out of the car and closed the door gently after him. The woods were quiet, the screams in town distant. He walked a little ways out from the hood and tried to think. Leaving town had been the right choice. They were still alive. The dome light in the car kicked off. Darkness closed in. He eased down onto the pavement and put his face between his knees, wept softly. After a minute, the car door opened behind him and the interior lights threw color on the road. His Wayward Pines wife walked over. "I said I needed a minute," Bob said. "Are you crying?" "No," he wiped his eyes. "Oh my God, you are. Leave me alone, please." "Why are you crying?" He gestured toward town. "This isn't enough." She sat down beside him. "You had someone, didn't you?" she said. "Before Wayward Pines, I mean." He made no response. "Your wife?" "His name..."
"His?"
"Was Paul." They just sat there in the road, breathing. Barbara finally said,
"This must have been awful for you."
"I'm sure it wasn't any picnic on your end."
"You never seemed like you were really..."
"I'm sorry."
"Me too."
"How is this remotely your fault?" "None of this was our choice, Barbara. You were never married before, were you?"
"You were my first.
In more ways than one." "God, I'm so sorry." "How is this remotely your fault?" Barbara laughed. "The 50-year-old virgin. And the queen."
"Sounds like a bad movie, doesn't it?" "How long were you and Paul?"
16 years. "I just can't believe he's dead, you know. That he's been dead for 2,000 years. I always thought I would be with him again."
"Maybe you still will."
"That's nice of you to say." She reached over, took hold of his hand, and said,
"These last 5 years, you're all I've had, Bob. You always treated me with care, with respect."
"I think we made it work about as well as it possibly could."
"And we did make damn good muffins."
Somewhere out there, gunshots echoed across the valley.
"I don't want to die tonight, honey," she said.
He squeezed her hand. "I'm not going to let that happen." Belinda Moran. The old woman sat in her leather recliner, the footrest extended, a dinner tray on her lap. By candlelight, she turned the cards over halfway through a game of solitaire. Next door, her neighbors were being killed. She hummed quietly to herself. There was a jack of spades. She placed it under the queen of hearts in the middle column. Next, a 6 of diamonds. It went under the 7 of spades. Something crashed into her front door. She kept turning the cards over, putting them in their right places. 2 more blows. The door burst open. She looked up. The monster crawled inside, and when it saw her sitting in the chair, it growled.
"I knew you were coming," she said. "Didn't think it'd take you quite this long."
10 of clubs. No home for this one yet. Back to the pile. The monster moved toward her. She stared into its small black eyes.
"Don't you know it's not polite to just walk into someone's house without an invitation?" she asked.
Her voice stopped it in its tracks. It tilted its head. Blood from one of the neighbors, no doubt, dripped off its chest onto the floor. Belinda laid the next card.
"I'm afraid this is a one-player game," she said, "and I don't have any tea to offer you."
The monster opened its mouth and screeched a noise out of its throat like the squawk of a terrible bird.
"That is not your inside voice," Belinda snapped.
The Abbey shrunk back a few steps. Belinda laid down the last card.
"Ha!" she clapped. "I just won the game."
She gathered up the cards into a single deck, split it, then shuffled.
"I could play solitaire all day, every day," she said. "I've found in my life that sometimes the best company is your own."
A growl idled again in the monster's throat.
"You cut that right out," she yelled. "I will not be spoken to that way in my own home."
The growl changed into something almost like a purr.
"That's better," Belinda said as she dealt a new game. "I apologize for yelling. My temper sometimes gets the best of me."
Ethan.
The light in the distance was getting closer, but he couldn't see a thing around him. Tripping every few steps, he tore his hands as he grasped for branches in the dark, wondering, could the abbeys track us, by scent, sound, sight, all of the above? The torchlights were close. He could see his group in the illumination. Ethan came out of the trees at the base of the cliff. There was already a line of people moving like ants up the rock, the glow of torches high above like a strand of Christmas lights strung across the cliff. Ethan had climbed this route only once before, while infiltrating the Wanderers, Kate and Harold's secret group. Steel cables had been bolted into the rock in a series of harrowing switchbacks over man-made footholds and handholds. A dozen people stood around the base of the cliff, waiting their turn to ascend. He looked for his family, but they weren't among them. Hector walked over.
"This is a bad idea," he said. "Putting children on the cables in the dark?"
Ethan thought of Ben, drove it out of his mind.
"How many are coming?" Hector asked.
"More than we can handle." Down the mountainside, Ethan could hear branches snapping. He had a pocket full of 12-gauge shells, and he started feeding them into the magazine while he watched the edge of the forest. With the last shell in the tube, he leveled the shotgun on the woods, thinking, "Not yet. Just a little bit longer, please." Hector tapped Ethan's shoulder and said, "It's time." They went up the rock face, clutching the freezing cable. By the time Ethan reached the third switchback, the forest below him was alive with screams and shrieking. Wails lifting up through the trees. The nearest torch was 20 feet above, but the stars were numerous and bright enough to light the rock. Ethan glanced down the cliff as the first abbey came out of the trees. Another appeared, and another, then 5 more, then 10. Soon there were 30 of them gathered at the base. He kept climbing, trying to focus on clutching the cables and making sure-footed steps, but every time he looked down, there were more abbeys than before. The rock went vertical. He wondered how Teresa and Ben had fared. Were they safe in the Wanderer's Cavern now? Above him, a scream that plummeted in his direction. Closer, 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 closer. Growing exponentially louder until it was right on top of him. He looked up as a man rocketed past, arms flailing, eyes gaping wide with horror. He missed Ethan by 2 inches, and his head struck a ledge 20 feet below, the blow sending him somersaulting the remaining distance toward the forest floor in dead silence.
Jesus.
Ethan's legs felt like liquid. A tremor moved through his left foot. He leaned into the rock and clutched a handhold, shut his eyes, let the panic course through him and burn itself out. The terror passed. Ethan went on, pulling himself up foot by foot on the rusted cable,